Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Carl Cox.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time, the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And this week, we're joined by a man who's been at the forefront of one of the biggest cultural musical movements of the last 40 years. A DJ, producer, and label boss whose passion for techno, house, funk and soul helped catapult dance and club culture from the basement into the charts and into the global phenomenon that it is now. For many, he is the godfather of dance. My guest on The First Time this week is Carl Cox. You just heard The Latin Theme, a track by Carl that featured in Human Traffic, a film from the late 90s that did its best to reflect the rave culture that had swept the UK at the time. Over the next hour, we'll find out how Carl went from DJing his parents' parties when he was a kid to his legendary 16-year residency at one of the world's greatest clubs in Ibiza, all via a rundown gym in London that witnessed the birth of Acid House. We also talk about the tension between his own brand of electronic dance music and the behemoth that is EDM. But I start off by asking Carl, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
In my mum and dad's household, there was always music being played by my mum and my dad. They love music. They're Barbadians. They come from a small Caribbean island. They always had people coming over to their house playing soca music, calypso, country and western, reggae, funk. They would always have black music playing all the time, and I was just basically exposed to it. That was our household. It was, you know, in the morning we'd hear music, in the afternoon we'd hear music, and at night we'd hear it. So, you know, I'd put the pillow over my head, go, "Will you stop dancing, that noise?" You know, it was kind of like that most of the time. So I couldn't get away from it. But my dad loved music. He'll go to the record store, buy the latest Benny King record, or the latest Aretha Franklin, or James Brown, or all of the greats. He'd buy them all. And then one day, I was like, you know what, I've had enough of this. They're all downstairs and all dancing away to James Brown and stuff, and get up off of that thing, and they're screaming and going mad. And I came down on the banisters. I was about 8 years old, and my dad saw me in the banister, and he said, "Son," he said, "you can either go to bed and try and get some sleep, of course, or you can come down here and put these records on." So what do you think I did? Put these records on. And I was like, you know, late night, and I was staying up playing these records, you know, and all 7 inches. And I just got really interested in it from the get-go, you know. What does that sound like? That sounds like funk. That sounds like R&B soul. That sounds like Muddy Waters. And I was following the artists, and eventually I really got interested in it. So I went to the record shop with my dad, and the guys who were playing the music over the counter. My dad would be playing, I like that, I don't like this. Come home. And he would just put it straight on the record player and play all these records. And he would be setting that up for his gatherings at home. Get up, up. Eventually, we would uproot from my mum and dad's house and then go to their friends' houses, and they'll bring their son along with the record box and the records. He's plonk me in the corner. Don't move until we tell you. And that's it.
That's really interesting, because it's like one of those you obviously loved. It was, it's special. You're staying up late, and you're, and it's friends and family. So already there at the start, you've got this idea, the joy of getting people excited about what you're doing and how special it is staying up late to do that. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I think it was probably the worst case of child labour you've ever seen. I was surprised the people didn't call the authorities on my dad, you know. You know, I mean, I did get to get to drink some orange juice and maybe sometimes some Coca-Cola from my troubles. I didn't know what I was doing at the time. It was just something that I did. And I was doing it, and I enjoyed it. So, I don't think I had much of a choice of my career path in the end, to be honest.
And music played a big part in the kind of community where you lived as well in London. Like, it was an important thing, with family, friends, with a wider kind of area then.
It was always the premise of any gathering. And my mum and dad used to have, like, dinner parties. And it was a dinner, it was over. You'd pull back the tables and chairs and have a party in the house, you know. And they'd be all smoking and drinking and carrying on and just enjoying themselves. They had, like, a mini club. And then when my dad finally bought a stereo, a left and right JVC multi-system, and then we were the kings, you know what I mean? It was like, oh, yeah, take this and stereo. Ooh, look at us. And that's how it went.
And you said Diana Ross, Love Hangover, which is an amazing song, was one of the earliest things you can remember.
Well, this is the thing, you know, I was always going record shopping with my dad. And then I was listening to radio, I was writing down the music that I liked and that kind of stuff. And I never really had any true money to go and spend on records because we just didn't. You know, at the end of the day, my dad had the money. But I used to do a paper round or milk round, and the extra money that I got from that, and then I would go and start buying my own record collection. And I remember going to a record shop in a place called Sutton, Surrey, called Our Price. That's when my dad used to go and record
shop. Yeah, I remember Our Price.
Our Price. And they were all over the place, right? They were the chains of Our Price. And I heard this record, Diana Ross, Love Hangover, on the radio. And I asked the guy, I said, oh, do you have Diana Ross on Tamla Motown Records? And he was like, we've kind of sold out of that at the moment, but we're going to get some in for next week. And do you want me to put one aside? I said, yeah. And it was something like 60p or something. And I was like, okay, we've got a pound, you know, you've got 40 pence left out of 60. I'm going to get some chewing gums and stuff, you know. so that's how it went, you know. So I went in out, Diana Ross, Love Hangover, I got it, 7-inch. And that was my offering to my dad's kind of record collection and what I would play. So what I loved about that record, Diana Ross, Love Hangover, was it was so amazingly written and arranged and produced, and her vocal delivery. I was just like, this is one of the most amazing tracks I've ever heard. But it was a ballad to begin with. The beginning of the song is a ballad. It wasn't a disco cut as such. Right. So I thought that was a song. But as soon as it went, I'm like, oh my God, where's this going? And as soon as it went that, it faded out because it had already had its 3 minutes, 20 seconds.
Oh no.
So there had to be an extended version somewhere. So I was waiting and waiting for the album to drop. And then as soon as the album dropped and I found it, and the extended version was 11 minutes, 26 seconds long. Yippee! Uh-huh. That's the tune. And I used to play that from beginning to end, that record.
Sweetest hangover. I don't.
So you're getting a bit older. Was there a career path aside from music, or was it always like, this is the only thing I am going to do?
No, my dad was always opposed to me being a DJ in any way, shape, or form. He's like, this is not a proper job, you know, and earn some proper money, you know what I mean? You know, he never saw it. I mean, the thing is about being a DJ at that particular time, the only way you could really carve a career was to be on the radio. And I was old enough to do that, to be honest, and I wasn't even old enough to be in the club. So I was really in this kind of no man's land of a career path as such. Apart from when the school wanted to have some music, they would come to me because I had the collection of records and a player. So I would take my stuff to school and play music. And this is where I kind of knew that I was kind of a little bit out of the box to everyone else at that particular time, because no one else had a collection of music like I had, or the knowledge of music, or even a record player at that time. So I really did start very, very early, very innocently, but I needed to have money. So I actually ended up leaving school, going to college for electrical engineering and being a motor mechanic. And then eventually I ended up going into the building trade, working as a labourer, doing carpentry and doing chippy work, and anything that was basically built in, I was into, because it was good money at that time. And at that particular time, I was actually building up a little sound system because of my electrical engineering. But I was building speaker boxes and making amplifiers and that. So I started basically building my own sound system at that particular time. I had a couple of friends of mine around me, a guy called Leroy James and Ray Locke. Ray Locke had the turntables and the mixer. Leroy would provide some of the sound system, and I put my sound system with his one and build it up. It was something from that particular point, 77, 78, 79, I was getting known for, you know, the guy that would bring the music as an entertainer. You know, I would do birthday parties and do functions at houses and that kind of thing, and school discos, of course, which was a big thing at that particular time. And then eventually I ended up doing my friend's wedding, and then I started getting bookings for weddings and stuff like that. It was so innocent. But I just thought, even though this is still a hobby, I never really saw it as something that I could have as a career path. You know, if you did a gig, you got like a couple of beers, a bit of petrol money, and, you know, thanks a lot sort of thing. You know, you were great, mate, you know, at that particular time. I was always following Robbie Vincent and Jeff Young, also listening to Kenny Everett on the radio. So the radio, it was calling me in some ways, but I still wasn't quite there with that. I liked the ideal that I was DJing to people in front of me rather than DJing into a microphone. And also, I wasn't old enough. I was like 15, 16, 17 years old at that time. And I was still learning about life as well, so about which path I was going to take. Was I going to be an astronaut? Was I going to be a football player? Was I going to play the piano? DJing wasn't the thing. It really was not. And eventually I came to a crossroads in 1985, I think it was, where I was getting quite a bit of work as a DJ, but also I was working really hard as a scaffolder. And then I decided that I would go into the world of being an entertaining DJ, self-employed, and I got a grant from the Prince's Trust.
I didn't know that.
£1,000. If I could show that I had £1,000 in my equipment, they would give me £1,000 to start up my small business, and my small business was being a self-employed DJ.
I know that Herbie Hancock was someone that you've got a lot of love for.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, the kind of soul, the funk and soul thing is just so important to you.
Mm.
What was it about his music that you kind of tuned into specifically then?
I think with Herbie Hancock, I mean, he's a jazz player. Unbelievable soulful pianist. The notes he would hit and play, it all came from his heart, and it came easily. But what I loved about him even more so, that he was also thinking about the future of the music that he could create with the technology of synthesizers and early samplers. I was just like, you're the man. Normally when you're a jazz player, you keep it contemporary and you continue to play jazz forevermore. But he went into the realms of electronica. And of course, when Rocket came out, that was it. Number one in all the charts, and even Top of the Pops and all sorts of stuff. The video came out. And then he went back into contemporary jazz again and making jazz music. And so he made his point, he made his statement. He set the world on fire. And he went back to his roots.
Obviously, like, an important moment is going to be the first time that you sort of tapped into the kind of underground, I guess. Would Acid Tracks be, like, the first door into, like, or would it be Time to Jack? What would be the track when you were like, hang on, this, I haven't heard anything like this?
Yeah, Time to Jack. I remember really clearly, I was doing a house party, playing all my funk and all my soul and playing Brass Construction, Moving and all this, or Bamma Boogie Woogie, all these amazing tunes. And I thought, right, this is it. This 12-inch cut from Chicago. Okay, are you guys ready for this? This is in my head, you know? So I played it. Dun, 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 Time to Jack. Cleared the floor. Cleared it. People looking at me, what? What is this? What are you doing? You know, what's this music? It's so dumb. We don't get it because, A, it was something like 124 beats per minute, where forevermore I've been playing down-tempo, funky cuts. And I was like, oh, maybe you lot are not ready for this just yet. But I followed the path. I'm like, I need another one of them records. I need another one of them records. I need another one that sounds like that. I need this. I need that. I need this. So any opportunity to find more of that type of music, I was right there, right at the beginning. And then I knew it was my time to come through whatever realm we're going through now with music. This was my music.
It's kind of difficult to underestimate the importance of Shoom as a club and as it kind of almost setting the template for like a whole scene, even though it was such a kind of small place. Its influence far outweighed its size, and you did the opening night. And I was kind of wondering what memories you had of that first night, because obviously things get turned into legends and often the legend isn't quite like the reality. Often the reality is a little bit more scruffy and seat of the pants than the legend. What can you remember much about that night?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, with most respect for Danny and at that time Jenny Ramplin for putting on such an event. But you know, there was no template for what we were doing at that particular time. We were just young guys, young girls coming together with this sound of music, which was just on fire, but it was to do with what we understood and no one else. It was almost like a cult that understood that if you heard this music with the right amount of people in this room with this sound, it was for us and nobody else. So that I had a sound system at that particular time. Danny asked me, he came down to a club in Kingston at Cinderella's, and Danny came up to me and goes, hey, you know, I know you and your music and stuff, and you have this sound, would you like to bring, you know, your sound system and your music? I'll pay you and all that. And I was like, yeah, no worries. I'll come. And because the thing is, any outlet for this type of music, I was there. I was like, this is great. This is now another step towards people understanding this music. And so, you know, I got my van and got some friends down, and we get to this place in Southwark Street, and it's a fitness center, and it's downstairs, so I've got to get my big speakers down the stairs. And it was like, you know, we got down the stairs, and then the exit was like two more feet, and it was the exit the other side. I was like, this ain't big at all, you know. This is tiny, because they moved all the machines out of the way, which, you know, you couldn't really hide them all. They still had to be in a room with covers on them, so you had a sort of minimum amount of dance floor space. There wasn't really a bar. There were some toilets at the back, and they had mirrors all around, and they put in these kind of day glow sheets around it, so when he went in, he really kind of looked around, and he was just like, where am I? You were transported somewhere else. Day glow, you know, the black light, smoke machine, you know. I brought all this stuff down and set it up, and put the sound system in it. You know, my sound was quite big, and then for that room, it was way too big for the room, but hey, you know, that's what they wanted. So we went down there, and anyway, we saw the crowd outside. These guys wearing afros, big platform shoes, flares, you know. They thought it was a funky all-night party.
Like, disco, you know, thing, right.
Yeah, they really thought it was that type of an event. And I'm thinking, you guys have got this so wrong. You know, because all these other guys, people are coming in with like dungarees and, you know, smiley faces, you know, bandanas and all this sort of stuff. You know, type, you know, getting ready to jack. And these guys are getting ready to get down. I'm thinking, man, you know, if you go down there, you're going to feel out of place. So the first night was a bit of a misunderstood night. But the people who were there absolutely lapped it all up. And then I was unleashed with the music that I've been collecting for that, and I've got people that understood my collection of music, which was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. So I actually did it for 2 months, and then they decided that they wanted to use someone else, which they did, and that was my legacy of playing at Shum with Danny Ramblin. And of course Shum, you know, went on to higher heights, and my path then took a left turn and went to another path. So, you know, it was a great introductory, and I understood it very much so, because I was there from the beginning.
What would be a key tune from that time for you then?
Promised Land with Joe Smooth. It was just one of those records you've heard everything in the end of the night, and you get to that point in the record, and you're almost in tears. The joys, the oneness of everyone singing together, the way how it brings everyone together. It's house music, it's driving. You know, Angels from Above. Oh, you know, it's just the perfect record, really. When I played that space, you know, before it closed, you know, I had everyone in tears when I played that record. And I'm thinking to myself, this is like 20 years old since it came out. In fact, it's probably longer than that. And I'm playing it today, the original version, and it still connects. So that has to be one of the most seminal records ever made that came out at that time.
Talk about that first single, because it was like a hit straight off the bat, wasn't it? It was another one of those moments where you were exactly placed in kind of music cultural force to sort of, that song was perfect for that moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It is all about the moment, because the record was kind of made up from other people's records. So I'd have the break beat was from one record, I Want You from another record, the actual vocal sample. The actual keyboards was played by a guy called Martin Lascelles to give it its original essence on that. And I was playing kind of rave breakbeat sound at the time, so we got some ravey samples, and I was stuck them in there to make the drama of the whole tune. But it had an essence of being dark and light and beautiful at the same time, and hard, because it was seen as a hardcore rave record at that particular time. But I was at the height of that sound, that scene, and that music. And then Paul Oakenfold, he saw me doing this mix live and everything. He goes, you know, that tune you're doing, he goes, why don't you put a little demo together and then let me hear it? And I was like, okay, there it is. He said, why don't you put you in a studio, put that together and see how we go? I'm like, well, okay. So we're in the studio, put it together, and we literally did I Want You Forever in one night.
Way.
And then Paul heard that record in one night. He came in, done a couple of little tweaks on the mix. Then the next time we went in the studio, we went in and balanced the track out, and then we put it together, and there's a record. It was done in 2 days. Two days, that record, put together. We got the records out to certain radio stations, certain DJs. Then we did a quick video to it, and then it was all put in place into the marketing and everything. And all the radio stations played it, went number one, Record Mirror, NME, or... I'm like, oh my God, I literally, one day nobody heard this record, and the next day, you know, Carl Cox, who's this DJ? Carl Cox, bang, bang, bang. And Paul was like, right, you've gone in at number, I think, 32 or something in the top 40. I'm like, really? I said, yeah, yeah. He goes, we're going to make a video. I said, what do you mean make a video? He said, yeah, yeah. And then I had to go into Pineapple Studios because we're going on Top of the Pops. And Top of the Pops, at that particular time, all the artists had been miming for years and years. And they decided at the time, I'm going on Top of the Pops, that we want you to sing it live. I'm like, what? You want me to do I Want You Forever Live? It's the most sampled record of all time. And you want me to do it? Oh my, God. So I had to play live, do the cuts live with this vocalist. And I'm trying to just ham it up on the turntable, like, trying to cut it all in. Oh, jeez. And then two weeks after that, they went back to miming again. I can't catch a break here. But the record went in 32, went in, I think, number 28, went up to, I think, number 20 or 19, and that's as far as it went. But I was the only DJ at that particular time that had a top 20 hits record.
That was Carl Cox, I Want You Forever, his top 20 single released in 1991. Now, even if you're not going on holiday at the moment, we need you to pack your bags, because next we're flying over to the Balearics to hear how a little island there played its part in Carl Cox's career. But first, it's the Six Music News.
Six Music.
This is BBC Radio.
Six Music.
BBC News at 1:30. This is Anthony Birchley. The Vaccines Minister, Nadeem Zahawi, has said people in England will still be expected to wear face coverings in many enclosed settings after the COVID rules lifted. The government's expected to confirm tomorrow that most of England's lockdown rules will end on the 19th of July. Face coverings will remain mandatory in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. The head of the FA has described the mood in the England football camp as calm ahead of their biggest game since the 1966 World Cup. Mark Bullingham said the team's success in Euro 2020 had gone beyond football and brought England together after a difficult 15 months. They face Italy, who haven't lost in 33 matches. Our correspondent in Rome, Lucy Williamson, says the knives are out for England in the Italian press.
Looking at the newspapers here in Italy, looking at social media, it's being framed as everything from Catholics against Anglicans to stopping the European trophy going to a nation that's just left the EU. And if any way you slice it, this is gearing up to be a real battle.
The UK's most senior military officer has said the major gains made by the Taliban in Afghanistan since the withdrawal of NATO troops don't necessarily mean the militant group will be able to take control of the whole country. The Chief of the Defence Staff, General Sir Nick Carter, said he was doubtful the Taliban could retain power in areas it had seized. He described the Afghan government's current strategy as sensible.
They're not going to fight for every rural area because they don't need to. What they need to do is to retain the provincial capitals, the wherewithal to supply those provincial capitals, and therefore control over the majority of the population, who are now increasingly urbanised. And I think the challenge the Taliban have got is, can they govern as much of those rural areas as they've now got?
A Spanish customs officer has died when a helicopter pursuing suspected drug traffickers across the Strait of Gibraltar crashed into the sea. Two other crew members were rescued. And Novak Djokovic will attempt to equal Roger Federer's record of 20 Grand Slam titles when he faces Matteo Berrettini in the final of Wimbledon this afternoon. That's Six Music News. More in an hour.
Six Music. On your digital radio,
smart speaker,
and the BBC Sound app.
This is Six Music.
First time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we ask an influential musician about the pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. And this week I'm talking to a man who many regard as the greatest DJ of all time, Carl Cox. And you just heard his reworking of Geraldine Hunt's Can't Fake the Feeling. Before the break, we were talking about the birth of Acid House in the UK, a movement whose roots were very much planted in the island of Ibiza. I asked Carl about his very first trip to the island.
The first time I went was about 1986. And I went with my girlfriend at the time, Maxine, and my sister. And we didn't really have that much money, so we did it like this. So we got a cheap flight, landed, picked up a Fiat Panda, and we drove to San Antonio and parked in a car park with shade and slept in that thing for two nights, with waking up in the morning, blaring sun coming through the glass and everything, because the Fiat Panda, the back seats can go down. So me and my girlfriend at the time was at the back, and my sister Pamela was at the front, on the front seat like this, and we were trying to save as much money as we could, you know, for that hour week. Well, eventually this is stupid, let's find a hostel, and eventually we found a hostel at the West End. I mean, you never got any sleep up there at all. It was so raucous up that street. But it was exciting, you know. It's not like Blackpool at all. This is just... we don't know what this is, but, you know, where's all the Spanish people? No Spanish. It's all English, Dutch, German, everyone but Spanish people. Anyway, so that was my introduction to being in Ibiza. But, I got to experience all the clubs from that point. There was a club there called Exorcist, which is now closed. Then eventually I saved up enough money to go to Koo, and then I saved up enough money on a med ped from San Antonio to space, 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, and to go in a club at 7 o'clock in the morning, you know, till you got, you know, kicked out basically about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, was just brilliant, you know. It's when space opened up, they didn't really have a clue of where it was going to actually go. It was just one of those things that they did. And then eventually, you know, they started to get it organized based on the certain nights and type of events they wanted to pull off in the end. But it was always Balearic. It was always had a Spanish feel to it. So and there was always Spanish nights as well as the nights that was curated by promoters. But I understood it from the very beginning what was required and how you had to basically intertwine the people who live and work on the island by what you was adding to the essence of their nights. And that took a while for the kind of management of the owners of the club to understand, for your club to work in the way that you would like to see it, we have to work together.
Man with a Red Face by Laurent Garnier, a track championed by Carl Cox and an Ibiza classic. I wondered why, having spent so much time in clubs all across the island, he finally found a home DJing at Space.
So in the early days, they had Nicky Holloway, Junior Boyzone, this kind of stuff going intertwining into those clubs and working with the club managers at those places, like Pasha, for instance, Ministry of Sound. If you look at what happened at Space, you know, Sundays at Space was run by the guys that used to run Cream in Liverpool. It was just nice to be able to mix the English and the Dutch and the Germans together. And then eventually it became part and parcel of the island's success. But I was always a DJ that would work for anyone that was doing anything for the right reason. And then eventually I found my home, which was Space.
Yeah, 15 years. I mean, there's got to be something special that happens there when you performed that you just had to keep coming back and revisiting. I'm just kind of wondering about how it feels when, you know, you've played everywhere.
Well, the thing was about me being on the island, I always enjoyed the island first. I never went there with a dream. I went to all those early clubs. I mixed with the locals. I enjoyed myself. I understood what was required to respect the island for what it is and enjoy your surroundings and everything that goes with it. That's how I started. I went every year just to enjoy that. I never went there with tapes to go, you know, you need to book me because I'm brilliant and that's what I could bring a crowd and, you know, you give me some tickets and, you know, you just pay me in vodka and orange, you know what I mean? I didn't do it that way. I did it purely on merit and an understanding. And that's how, I mean, at the particular time, 1991, I would imagine, was where I was, still wasn't kind of booked by the clubs, but I was working in a club called Stearns in Worthing for a guy called Mensah, who's not around anymore, unfortunately. But this club was basically the best kind of rave club in the South Coast. And out of all the places that this club was, Worthing of all places. And it was legendary. They had an idea of taking their club with their DJs to Ibiza and have me be the lead DJ for that. They did Chaos Club, where we played, and then they did Summum, where they had also me playing as well. And both of these nights was absolutely phenomenal. People came everywhere. They'd never seen so many people coming from all sides of the sound and the music, the rave and techno music and everything. It just, from that point, it changed everything in some ways. But also, it put me in the eyesight of all of the clubs. So I kind of had to pick and choose of what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. So I ended up playing Manny Mission, DJ at Amnesia, guest DJ at Pasha. But I was kind of moving around. I was kind of sharing the love by what I was doing, but I never really had a home. And with that, Space was always a place I went to enjoy. But then when Pepe and Fritz Pangratz at the time was managing the club and Pepe obviously owns the club, they could see that there was something going on with me of which they felt then this is the guy. And that's still, don't forget, I wasn't a main kind of go-to DJ at the time. Sasha was, Paul Oakenfold, Danny Ramplin, Pete Tong, we were being Radio 1 in. I was still kind of like a DJ box boy, really. At the end of the day, that's how I felt. You know, Eddie Gordon would say, Carl, you know, if you set up the terrace for us at Space, you know, we give you a couple of £100 and you know, but if you could do that for us, that'd be great. And I'd be, yeah, no worries. I'll play for 6 hours, house music. And literally the terrace was born when we did that. They knew what I could bring to the table. It's a reason why eventually they asked me if I would like to do my own night at that club. Well, actually, it was a Thursday night when we started first, and we was kind of a competition with, at that particular time, with Amnesia, with Cream. So we went from Thursday to Tuesdays, and then that was it. Carl Cox Tuesday Nights Revolution, that Space was born. After year 3, year 4, okay, this is where we're at. Year 5, okay, well, time to go. And it went year 6, year 7, year 8, year 9. What? We've gone to 10 years at Space. All right, let's celebrate it. Yee, 10 years at Space. You know, champagne, caviar, what you call it, whatever you like. You know, play till the morning and whatever. And then, of course, in between all of that, they started having all the car park sessions. So that really put on the emphasis on the opening parties and closing parties. For now, where they was only having 6,000 or 7,000 people, they could have 15,000. So it really did grow exponentially. And then year 11 turns up, and we have more people. That, I mean, we were selling tickets without even giving them the lineup. It's just that people did not want to miss whatever we were going on. They trusted us to make sure that night was seminal. You know, year 11 was amazing. 12, 13, 14 is when we got notice of that the club's going to get taken over, just shut down. And so we had 2 more years. And then 16th year, 16 came, and that was it. And that was the end of that legacy. If it never happened, I'd still be doing that club today at high level. People associated me with that club so hard, it just wasn't funny. Everywhere around the world was, you know, oh, you're that Ibiza DJ. I was like, yeah, I played Ibiza, but I played Greece, Italy, Germany, France, England. You know what I mean? That's how hard that the association that I had with that club, but also how important it was for me at the end of the day, based on my career. It really did stand for something, you know, more than I ever thought. My next residency radio show for Radio 1 is all about that, actually, my music on the terrace. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of people listening to that, but they're going to be quite shocked because the music that I've chosen to represent, Space IB for the terrace sound, it's not all about classic hits records. It's about the records that made the terrace. So you have to be there to understand it. When you was at the Space Terrace, you never had a mobile phone. Nobody even knew. Nobody even knew you were there. Nobody knew that Joe Mary Choir was there, or any celebrity, because that's what it was. No cameras, just you and it. And if you remember these kind of tracks and how it made you feel, and then my show is all about that. You had to be there.
How did you feel about the EDM movement
kicking off in the States, because I think if it was me, I'd have very mixed feelings about it, because part of me would think, this is great, there's some DNA in what I do that's reached this colossal audience, and there's showmanship, and I think that's brilliant. The other part of me would be thinking, you've lost something here in the spectacle. I would have mixed feelings. I just wonder what yours were about.
Yeah, and mine are mixed feelings. I think one of the biggest mixed feelings was a misrepresentation of the word or the letters of EDM, electronic dance music. Because electronic dance music to me was Gary Numan, Cars. You know, that's electronic dance music, which has nothing to do with the electronic dance music that you're listening to, or what the perception of it is today. Now, the Americans had to adopt something with this movement, and they could only basically adopt it by having a tag that, at the end of the day, you could have a kind of like a DJ concert based on the electronic dance music, EDM. And the sound was so accessible by the DJs that became popular in EDM, being misrepresented based on my electronic music sound. My electronic dance music was Detroit techno, was UK techno, German techno, Dutch techno. But you can't put all that under the umbrella of EDM, because as soon as you say that, they think you're playing the commercial sound of what the Americans call electronic dance music, which have absolutely nothing to do with each other. You have EDM on one side, but you have this movement on the other side, whether it be minimal, whether it be tech house, whether it be tech funk, tech jazz, electro, whatever. But you can't call that EDM. It's impossible. Yeah. So there were some points where I just felt like if I wanted to take that career path of being an EDM DJ, I literally would be making billions by playing music that I hate, because it wouldn't be my sound. It's rife everywhere. I remember going to Singapore and listening to all the EDM Asian DJs, and it was so accessible, commercial, like Pikachu, you know, Nintendo with songs that they all sing, and they all jump up and down at the same time, and they were all looking at the DJ and singing a song, and they all got their hands in the air, and I'm like, wow. I mean, this is a concert. This is not an event. This is not a festival. This is a concert under the umbrella of EDM. And there's a place for that. Of course there is. But you can't call what we've gone through and where we've ended up is that. We still have to be under the umbrella of the purest form of the sound, which is house music and electronic music.
What is it about techno as an art form? Because it was born out of such a brutal industrial landscape and a really tough time kind of socially for the community of that city. And it's become something so powerful. You hear it in not just nightclubs in Berlin, but you hear it all around the world, in the Middle East and Africa. It's become almost a music of defiance. So it's almost got like a political power to it, because it stands for so much. It almost stands for freedom in lots of places. I just wondered, it's at your heart, isn't it, techno?
Yeah, you know the maddest thing about the techno music? I mean, look, I'm a black guy that loves, you know, hard industrial 4/4 music. It's almost non-soulful, but I try and play the most soulful element of that music. So I don't like hard panel beat in techno. It's too cold for me. It's like bam, 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 bam. You know, your next record, please. You know, there has to be an element of groove, funk, power element. That's why I really enjoyed the early trance sound of techno music, because it has so much melody, foresight in the music. When you heard some of the producers make that music, they really felt what they were creating and what they were making. And I think my defining moment of representing this music or this sound was the Fact album when it came out through React, because there was a lot of records on there which still have its defining moments, like the Orange Theme, was Cygnus X was one of them, Werner's Wonderland was another one. Of course, the Café Del Mar was another one. But this kind of like idea of techno music with hard techno music was always a button pusher. It was kind of how far can we go with this? I mean, I went all the way up to my BPMs from 124 BPM, and I went all the way up to, I think, about 180. And then I'm like, well, they're talking about soul up here. So let's just come back down a little bit. And I'm kind of carried, I was around about 150, 145 tech house at the particular time. And then eventually I came down on the BPMs all the way down to about 126, 128. And that's where I've kind of sat. I've sat around about that area. I'm kind of pushing the BPMs a little bit more now, because right now there's another resurgence of the techno movement sound with acid house sounds. Right now, you know, the girls are doing it for themselves. Emily Lenz and Charlotte DeWitt, Deborah DeLuca, Nastia, and Fissa Lelago. These girls are coming in and absolutely breaking the place. Ellen Allen, Nicole Modolva, and they're coming in and playing good techno, and they're pitching. But in some ways, again, it's kind of like what they're doing now is what I used to do. So I don't really want to get involved in that either, because for me, it's like another resurgence of something that I kind of got into at the time, but then moved away from because I wanted to kind of do something else. But it's actually cool to see that the now generation are getting into the real stomp of techno music instead of the EDM sound. I'm just kind of like old enough now to go, you know, I'm kind of seasoned now, so I kind of like, I like my chords and my arrangements in the music and that kind of thing. So I just love the fact that it's all techno. I remember people like, I don't like Carl Cox because he plays that hard techno music. But then I play this music and they'd be dancing. And I think, what are you talking about? I said, that's my hard techno music. Oh, yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, I kind of like it. Before, for me, techno was a dirty word for me. I won't go and see Carl. He plays too hard. The DJs that are playing now were playing harder now than I was when I was playing this music to begin with. So it's not scary anymore. Oh, Carl Cox plays techno music. Yeah, of course he does. He's, you know, and I'm just like, oh, man. You know, to be accepted took a long time for people to go, okay.
And the final question. We always ask everybody to pick the last track that the show will go out on. So what should we go out on? What's the final song that we should play to finish the show?
Well, I think it's the only record I could play in the end of the day, which I think has such significance for me and anyone else that was there at that particular time. And that was the last record I played at Space. I tell you what, people had money on the record I was going to be playing at Space. What's going to be Carl Cox's last record? I want to know what it's going to be. It's going to be Promised Land. It's going to be Strings Alive. And it's going to be Your Love by The Prodigy. And everybody got it completely wrong. And it's this track, Angie Stone, I Wish I Didn't Miss You, which came out in 2001. Now, one of the reasons why I chose this record, because A, it has a sample from the OJs back in 1976 called The Backstabbers. So when you actually hear the first part of the record, it takes me back to my childhood. And when I first heard that record, Angie Stone, that's the first thing I felt of. And then when she, you know, she sings and it's beautifully made and it's just delicious. And I just thought, out of all the years I've ever played at Space, I've never played this record because it didn't fit anywhere that I was playing at that particular time. And I thought it'd be really fitting tribute, you know, to make it as the last record at Space, because it has a slight meaning. The actual song is about the boyfriend that cheated on her. I wish I didn't miss him when he gone. She still loved him, even though he was an idiot. But the actual title of that, I Wish I Didn't Miss You When You're Gone, I'm just like, that's how I feel about Space. I was in tears when I heard that. I'm like, that's got to be the record. When I played it, people just stood there looking at me going, what, you're playing? I've never heard you play that record. Well, that's a glorious Space, because Space was always about an experience of your night out. And it was a last minute decision to put that record in as a last record at Space. I was at a restaurant in Ibiza and the DJ was playing that record. And I'm like, oh my God, that's Andy Stone. I said to my friends around me, this is the last record I'm going to play at Space. So what I did was, I got the track from iTunes, put it into Ableton, I put a kick drum on it, little hi-hat, sped it up a couple of BPM, kept all the original arrangement to that record, done a couple of little effects at the beginning and the end, and that was my original mix that got played at that time. Nobody knew it. Everyone was like, oh, is that DJ's remix? Nah, that is an original Carl Cox re-edit of that song. And it's on Wikipedia now. If you go to Wikipedia, it's, oh yeah, Andy Stone, blah, 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 you know, made this record dinner. Oh, by the way, you know, DJ Carl Cox used it as his last record at Space. And there you go.
That's the song we should go out on. Thank you so much, mate. It's been so lovely to speak to you.
Likewise, absolutely. You know, I always get a kick out of talking about these things. I don't get to talk about them that often, and most people don't know the stories. They just see me out there having a good time, you know, drinking some champagne with my mates and, you know, playing some tunes, and then that's it until the next time. But there's always a story.
Special there. That was Carl Cox's very own edit of Angie Stone's Wish I Didn't Miss You. Thanks to Carl for talking to us, a total gent, and just brilliant stories, many more of which you can read in his memoir, Oh Yes, Oh Yes, which comes out next month. If you enjoyed the show, you can find previous episodes of The First Time on the BBC Sounds app. Just search The First Time. And I'll be back next week with another guest talking us through their musical firsts. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Six music.
This
is BBC Radio.
Six music.
Right now, it's Sole Purpose with Loyal Karma.
See, to live is to suffer. But to survive, well, that's the fine meaning in the suffering.
Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I got to get up. Get back on my feet so I can tear. Ayo, I'm slipping, I'm falling, I can't get up.
I'm slipping, I'm falling. I can't get up, hey yo, I'm slipping, I'm falling. I got to get up, get back on my feet so I can tear shit. I've been through mad different phases, like mazes, to find my way. And now I know that happy